Affairs to order. It's May 2nd, a nice day in Oregon. All right, I'd like to open, before I open, Senator Cruz is testifying, Senator Courtney is testifying. I'm going to need to leave to testify, so we apologize if we don't have a full complement of people here. But this is the first full day that we can hear House bills, and we're taking the non-controversial ones first, so there should be no problem with this. That I'd like to open a public hearing on HCR 4 and call Greg Leo and Charlotte Lehan to the...
Chairman Mons Anderson, Greg Leo, President of Friends of Historic Champaig. We are a nonprofit organization whose mission is to interpret the social and natural history of Champaig State Park, which is located in northern Marion County, and thereby hopefully enhancing the significant cultural resources for Oregon. We're here today in support of HCR 4, which is a celebration of the 200th birth of Robert Newell. Robert Newell is a remarkable historical figure, a man of many firsts who did many things in Oregon, start the first newspaper, bring the first wagon into the Willamette Valley, formed the town of Champaig and planted it. He was also there at the beginning of Oregon at Champaig, a first speaker of the Oregon House, a man of great public concern. With me today is Charlotte Lehan, the executive director of Friends of Historic Champaig. And she'd like to say a few words about our organization's support for HCR 4 and hopefully the support that we can get from our committee today to move HCR 4 to the Senate floor.
Welcome.
Yes, Chair Mons Anderson. I probably look a lot like the mayor of Wilsonville, but today I'm...
I know. Introduce yourself for the record.
We were going to say that.
Can we see
but
you
today,
the
my name is Charlotte Lehan. I'm the executive director of Friends of Historic Champaig. And I just thought I would explain a little bit as to why we have this bill, aside from it being Robert Newell's 200th birthday. He's a figure very important in Oregon history, as Mr. Leo has said, but he's kind of been overlooked. He was a close friend of Joe Meeks, and they were both trappers in the early days, and every Oregon school child, I think, knows, at least past the fourth grade, knows who Joe Meek was, but it's hard for a lot of people to name Robert Newell, even though he probably, when all said and done, had a bigger influence on the beginning of Oregon. So we're kind of trying to set the record straight or give him a bit of his due in that regard. And a couple of the other things, I think that he was kind of, aside from all of the firsts, in terms of the public affairs side of his life or the humanitarian side, he was a... By the time he had platted the town of Champaig and really founded it and had a substantial amount of land, he was a man of means. But when the flood of 1861 wiped out the town of Champaig and his house was really the only one above the floodwaters, they had 200 people. There was no loss of life, but 200 people who were homeless, and he invited them all to his home and his grounds. They wouldn't all fit in the house, but and for a period of 4 or 5 months put these people up and essentially bankrupted himself and ended up in dying in poverty pretty much because he had started this town and then gave himself to his neighbors in their time of need. He was also a friend of the Nez Perce, and his wife was the daughter of a chief of the Nez Perce, and so he went out of his way to try to take the side of the Indians in a lot of the affairs, and was the first
Indian subagent.
Indian subagent, right. And he was popular enough with the tribes that they deeded him, they actually deeded him part of their land and something that they hadn't done for anyone else. So so he walked in a lot of worlds and really tried to pull things together in early Oregon and deserves this recognition and maybe almost where Joe Meek is in terms of people knowing who he is.
May I just add in closing that in the frieze in the Senate chamber, if you look at the dais, of course, the mural is the coming of statehood in 1859, but if you look at the upper left-hand corner, you'll see Robert Newell's name. And so he oversees, or at least is up there looking down on the Senate, but, of course, his picture is in the House chamber behind the dais. If you look carefully at the Shampuig mural in the House chamber, he's the man with the hat, with the dark jacket, who's stepping just a little bit back from the front row where his best friend Joe Meek is calling for the divide. And this was kind of his place in history. He was always the guy just one step back and a little bit to the side supporting those who are helping form the state of Oregon. So we thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you. I always loved Oregon history, and I know that they really, I hopefully they still emphasize that in the schools.
Yeah.
I'm glad that you brought this forward. Is there any comments or discussion?
Madam Chair, just looking at the staff measure summary, it's always amazing to read the words of those who have gone before. And just looking at this passage, which was written by Robert Newell in 1840, it's quite something. Quite something.
Thank you.
Yeah. With that, I'll close the public hearing on HCR 4, and I'd like to open a work session on HCR 4.
Madam Chair, I move HCR 4A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Gordley moves HCR 4 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. And Senator Gordley, would you mind carrying that?
I would be honored. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
We don't have the people here for HCR 8. All of them. You, Stephanie Halleck, we will wait till she comes back. Okay? HJM 10, do we have? Okay, let's open a public hearing on HJM 10, and Ed Patterson, please come forward. And Paula Brown. Whoever wants to go first.
Good morning, Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Paula Brown. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and I'm here to go on the record for the department as supporting House Joint Memorial 10. I think that Chair Mona Sanderson, in her comments before the committee started in describing the bills, the memorials, and resolutions that you would be hearing as non-controversial, that's exactly how I'd take a look at this. The department is supportive, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Could you describe it? we need to know, for the record, what we're dealing with.
HJM 10 urges the President of the United States and Congress to remove the provisions of federal law that disqualify veterans' mortgage bonds from tax-exempt status if the bond proceeds are used for acquiring or replacing existing mortgages.
Mr. Patterson, would you want to give the history of how this came about?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Ed Patterson. I'm here today representing myself, and it was a little personal experience of how this came to my attention. And I really appreciate you hearing the memorial today, and I hope it is non-controversial. My oldest daughter spent 10 years on active duty in the U.S. Army, and during that time she met and married another active duty soldier. Their two sons were born as Army brats, And shortly after their youngest was born, they decided to try civilian life and were discharged and moved to Tualatin. She recently went through a divorce after her husband of 18 years walked out on her and her two teenage sons. She was awarded sole custody of the 14 and 16-year-old boys, who are now a freshman and a junior at Tualatin High School. To lessen some of their trauma for the boys, she wanted to keep the family home until they graduated from high school. She was awarded the house and their divorce settlement. I've been advising her on her financial affairs since the divorce was final and suggested that she refinance the home through an Oregon Veterans Loan. Much to my chagrin, she learned that she qualifies for an Oregon Veterans Mortgage Loan but does not qualify for a refinance loan for the house. I explained the dilemma to Representative Brian Boquist, who everyone knows has a lot of experience in Veterans Affairs, who made some inquiries on her behalf. He found that Public Law 99514 prohibits the five state veterans loan programs from granting refinance loans in the country. The only course of action available to us is to ask Congress to recognize this type of situation and change the federal law. It is ironic and I think nonsensical that a veteran can qualify for a loan to buy another home but cannot refinance the existing home. I urge the committee to adopt the memorial and recommend a due pass to the Oregon State Senate. Perhaps some divorced veteran in the future will be in a similar situation, and the Oregon Veterans Loan Program could come to his or her assistance. I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Madam Chair, I just want to make a statement. I think it was Senator Morissette who said on the floor yesterday, one of the things that happens to us is that we idolize our military people until they come home, and then we treat them as if they've never been in high levels of position. And this same thing happened to a family member of mine, but I never thought about this. And so I'm glad to see you bringing this before this committee and before the legislature. And I just don't care whether something is controversial or not, but when something is as simple as this, I don't know why we have to continue to not pay attention to it. I really worry about our veterans on so many fronts because we don't treat them home. We don't treat them well once they come home in terms of health care, in terms of housing, and issues of this nature. We've got to change this in this country. Mm-hmm. We're going to continue to idolize people as they go and fight a war for us, and they come back home, and things become complicated. That doesn't make sense to me. So I'm an avid supporter of this memorial today.
Better comment? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'll close the public hearing on HJM 10 and open a work session on HJM 10.
Madam Chair, I move House Joint Memorial 10 to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Gurley moves HJM 10 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. And I forgot to say, please have Senator Courtney and Senator Cruz as excused. And Senator Carter, would you mind carrying?
No.
All right. Close the work session on HJM 10. And is Stephanie here? Or can she be here? No? Okay. We will then move to HCR 5. I'd like to open a public hearing on HCR 5. And Shannon, do you want to give
sure.
us a summary?
HCR 5 commends Oregon health care providers for their efforts to ensure that all Oregon military personnel obtain needed medical care during deployment and active duty during the war on terror, requests Oregon health care providers to consider accepting United States Department of Defense TRICARE insurance program.
So, General Mike Caldwell, Paula Brown, and Mike Hanley?
Hanley.
Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, the Deputy Director of the Military Department. And what HCR 5 basically does is encourage medical providers in the state of Oregon to accept the TRICARE insurance program, which is administered by TriWest, represented by Mr. Hanley at my left. And to kind of give you a 30,000-foot overview of what happens is the Department of Defense has set up what is termed TRICARE, which is their managed health care program. for all service members. Traditionally, the Guard and Reserve were not members of this unless they were full-time people under one of the systems that we have available called the Active Guard Reserve Program. The majority of the Guardsmen and Reservists in the state of Oregon were not members of this group and were not eligible. As deployments began here 5 years ago, and they continued to increase, by virtue of these soldiers being put on active duty, federal active duty, they became eligible and their families became eligible. So suddenly we went from a very small group of maybe a couple hundred or 500 people in Oregon who were getting this managed health care insurance with very few providers to this balloon of 3,500, 4,000 participants. Providers were a lot of them not familiar, didn't understand it. There was bad taste in many of their mouths over the old DOD program, which was called CHAMPUS, which was a very bad program, and they refused to take patients. And many this legislature in 2005 actually changed the law so public employees who had health care through, in fact, as Senator Courtney was the sponsor of that legislation, that had health care through the state of Oregon or their local government, could continue on with that cost, and the state would pick it up due to the fact that so many providers refused to take TRICARE. That was problematic then, it's problematic now. It's getting better, and I'll tell you why it's getting better, and I'm not going to steal Mr. Hanley's thunder, but TriWest took over the program, 3 years ago?
Yes.
And they took over the program as the contractor for TRICARE. They've done an exceptional job. They've done a lot better job of getting folks paid quicker. They have a very efficient system. So providers were starting to get their money a lot sooner than they had under the old system. It's certainly been a good change. The major issue with it, however, is always, and it remains today, and when another issue we're working at the federal level is that currently the pay for service is regulated by the Medicare Medicaid rates that are established here in Oregon. So providers are still not eager to jump on this bandwagon because of the low rates. They're pleased that the pay is getting there sooner and quicker and more efficiently, but yet they're still at a loss, they believe, by serving. What TriWest, in conjunction with what we've been able to do in the Oregon National Guard, is to go out and work with providers and encourage them to become signed up under the program so our soldiers and families can get health care when they're deployed. To make matters, I guess, even more complicated, in October, the Congress has passed legislation that will allow all guardsmen and reservists to be in TRICARE, regardless if they've been called to Title X or not. The difference will be that while they're in their guard roles, or their inactive duty roles, we call it, non-deployed, they have to pay part of the fees, and I think it's $500 a year. They got to pay $500 a year for a soldier and their family. I have every reason to believe, given the healthcare situation that's going on in this state, that we're going to see a good number of our 8,400 mm-hmm. members of the Oregon Guard take advantage of that, so the load is going to even further increase. This committee will probably see another bill that came out of the House side Veterans Committee that offers a state tax incentive to providers that were working. Went through the Vets Committee. It's going to get over here. It needs a little tweaking, we think, but you'll probably get to see it as well. And again, the effort is try to encourage healthcare providers to become members of the TRICARE system under TriWest administration, so we can get more healthcare providers out there for our men and women. So that's the essence of this resolution, is to encourage and thank those that are there that are already providing this healthcare to the men and women in the armed services, and also to encourage them to more of them to get on board. So that's the general essence of this particular resolution. And we would certainly appreciate your support, and I'd be happy to answer any questions or pass it to the other two.
Good morning.
morning, Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Paula Brown. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and I'm here to express the department's support of HCR 5. Certainly, it goes along with what Senator Carter was verbalizing previously, in that when our men and women of the military services return to their states, they need to have the services available to them, and that certainly includes health care and is very important. TriWest, TriCare, Champus, the evolution of that program has made it a much more attractive program for physicians, and additional participation in that program certainly just makes the health care available, more readily available to the men and women who have served. And we would urge your support as well, and be happy to answer any questions.
Yes, good morning. I'm Mike Hanley, and I'm the Service Area Director for TriWest Healthcare Alliance for all of Oregon, all of Washington outside of the Puget Sound and northern Idaho. And I've been managing the TRICARE program here in Oregon since 1998. So as General Caldwell indicated, I managed the program under the previous contract, and I'm happy to be a part of managing under this contract. One of the things that makes the program unique in Oregon, the TRICARE program, is it is really the only state in the country that has the large population that we have, offers the HMO option as extensively as we do in the country, with no military treatment facility or military base. The only portion of my service area that functions as the program does in the rest of the country is Fairchild Air Force Base in Spokane. And that's really how the program was designed. And so we're kind of taking that program and trying to make it function like a commercial health care plan. And so literally our program lives and dies on our provider network. So anything we can do to encourage providers, we're working hard. And as General Caldwell said, our claims processing rate is 99.9%. We provide excellent customer service. Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon is our subcontractor, so we work in partnership with them to ensure that we're doing everything possible, that there aren't any outstanding claims and those kinds of things. So something like this, also encouraging the providers, would go a long ways in helping our cause. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Madam Chair?
Yes. Senator Carter and then okay. Senator Gordon.
Mr. Hanley, what do you think went wrong? I have personal experience with TRICARE.
Okay.
So what do you think went wrong in terms of the medical community and not being as respectful of TRICARE as they would have some of the carrier?
Well, I think, TRICARE is still a relatively young program.
Uh-huh.
In comparison to some of the more long-standing commercial health care programs. And like anything, when you first start out, what looks good on the drawing board can be sometimes a little bit different or unique when you start placing it on the ground. And under the previous contract, the Northwest was the first location that the new TRICARE program started out. So obviously there was a large learning curve. Claims were processing considerably slower. So over the course of those years, we were able to learn those lessons and be much more efficient. I will tell you, in terms of claims processing rates, that I've talked to a number of senior executives from the commercial health care plans, and without exception, almost every time that I speak to those senior executives, the first thing they say is, wish we had the claims processing rate that you guys do. Yeah. We can't even come close to processing claims and getting people paid as fast as you do. So I think we've made great strides. But as General Caldwell said, there's still some providers, especially probably more in the central and eastern Oregon, that think of it's basically nothing's changed. It's the old Champus program of 10 to 12 years ago. So one of the things that we do is we do actively go out and talk with those provider offices, and we also work with our net sub, Blue Cross Blue Shield, to try to educate them and ask them, give us a chance, give us 6 months, give us an opportunity to try to prove to you that it is not the same program. And those that have taken us up on that challenge have stayed and continue to see our folks.
What's your turnaround time in terms of not just claim processing but payment, repayment? 30 days, 60 days?
In terms of payment of claims?
Yes.
Average turnaround time for an electronically submitted claim is anywhere between 2 and 4 days. And
two and four?
Yes, ma'am.
And these people are having problems. We passed a bill here, you guys, a session or two ago, where people were trying to go from 60 days to 30 days. And here you are with 2 to 4 days.
Yes, ma'am, on electronic claim. Hard copy claims are probably anywhere 4 to 5 days.
So is it a marketing strategy you need to develop? Is that what would need to happen, General?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, I think what we have found, a couple things, is that, as I said earlier, TriWest has done an outstanding job of getting these claims paid. What we're living with and what we have found, and when I say we, our reintegration team teamed up with TriWest to go out and try to get providers and went and knocked on doors, talked to hospital administrators, talked to doctors groups. There is such a bad taste in many of these people's mouths about the CHAMPIS program, where literally the federal government would run out of this money in their budget item in April, and they would quit paying claims. They would still, people would go in and get service under CHAMPIS, and the doctors would submit, and their healthcare providers and companies and their private corporations and however they submitted their bills, and they didn't get paid till October, until the new fiscal year. And there are still people out there that say, tell us this all the time. And they think that's exactly what they're dealing with now. And as Mike indicated, they say, give us a chance and see if we can't do a better job. Now, ultimately, we still have a huge problem in this state because of the Medicaid rates.
Yes.
Because that is problematic, as you know, for yes. Medicare Medicaid patients as well as TRICARE, because that's what we're tied to. We don't have a choice on that. We're working at the federal level. And what we're asking, and we've asked Representative Hooley to work on, and she is working on it, I don't know if we'll get it through or not, but we're asking them to pick the highest Medicare and Medicaid rate in the nation, wherever that is. All TRICARE patients across the country get that rate. So if the best rate for a tonsillectomy is in Philadelphia, and it's 3 times what you get paid in Oregon, then we want that 3 times rate out of Philadelphia paid in Oregon. We think if we can get that done, we would really solve a lot of the problems that we have getting providers.
So it is a national government problem in terms
absolutely.
Of...
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely, Senator Carter. It is truly a federal issue. What this does is, again, as a matter of public policy and going on the record of this legislative body, asking medical providers to do the right thing at this point and take care of these patients. We had a young lady who just had her baby, works for us full-time at the military department, and there was one OBGYN that she could get into under TRICARE, and that was basically the only one between here and Portland, Medford. I mean, she had to go a long ways, and there's only one provider that would offer that service to pregnant people. So you have one provider in Salem, Oregon, for a population base of what? Couple million?
Mm-hmm.
That's ridiculous. Now, that's total population. Guard population, there's probably, I'm going to guess, 2,500 to 3,000 guardsmen and families that would be involved in that. It's just off the top of my head, maybe more. And that's the kind of thing we're fighting right now to try to get more providers in there, and that's what this resolution, we hope, will spur them along and get them excited about getting involved. Because we think, even though the pay's bad, it's quick.
Right.
So
exactly.
It's kind of like farming.
That's
yeah.
A couple of questions for did you?
No.
A couple of questions for you, but first let me just say that Senator Courtney, President Courtney, was called out to testify on another bill in Ways and Means, and he'll try to get back here as quickly as possible. I'm wondering, is this program, which was created in the early 90s, available to veterans, retirees of all wars?
Madam Chair, currently the veterans, if you have a retirement, a 20-year retirement, and you're a active duty 20-year retirement, and you're eligible for retirement benefits, I guess is the right term.
Okay.
And if you're eligible for retirement benefits, then yes, you can take, you can be on TRICARE.
All right.
Now that is for reservists, the guardsmen, reservists, that's, you're not eligible for those benefits until you're 60. If you're a 20-year retiree, you're eligible at age 60. If you're an active duty person, 20 good years, you're eligible the next day. So retirees, yes, indeed, get into this, and then guard and reservists get into it after they start receiving their retirement checks.
Great. Thank you for clarifying that. Also, just hearing about the challenges with the program in some areas of Oregon. I believe you said Central Oregon and one other.
Eastern Oregon.
Central and Eastern Oregon. Just an idea. You may want to invite legislators to go with you as you make those visits. It's a way of also educating the legislators representing those areas about the program this new program and how it's working, as well as building support for the new. For the new program, just an idea.
Senator Gordley, get out of my head, because I was going to go back and tell the general that once we've through this legislation, maybe legislators being a part of your marketing strategy.
I do know that it is the intent of Chair Mona Zanderson to move this bill, and hopefully if she makes it back before our adjournment time, we'll do that today. Thank you so much, all of you, for your testimony today. And for your service.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to close the hearing on HCR 5 and open a hearing on HCR 8. Shannon?
HCR 8 memorializes former State Senator Ted Halleck, who served in the Oregon Legislative Assembly from 1963 through 1983.
And we have three people signed up to testify, if they would all come up together. Judy Signet, Mike Dewey, and Stephanie Halleck.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Stephanie Halleck, and I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality and also Ted Halleck's daughter. I'm here today to just take a couple of minutes, first of all, to thank the committee for accommodating me needing to be in two places at one time this morning, along with Senator Courtney, and appreciation for the staff who helped do that. I'd also like to recognize Judy Signet, who is here today to speak. On the House side, she works for Representative Witt, and it was really through her efforts, after working for my dad for many, many years, that this resolution was introduced. I probably don't have to tell you too much about my father. It was a very interesting childhood, as you can imagine. Dynamic guy in many ways. I was reading last night a book called Footprints that Senator George Wingard wrote about the legislature in the 1970s, looking for perhaps something that I could share with the committee. But if you also recall about my dad, he was relatively colorful, and there's probably nothing that I would want to say on the record in Ted Halleck language today. But the thing that struck me reading the book is that in the 1970s, they were dealing with many of the same issues that we are dealing with today, particularly around the environment, which I'm very much involved with, but also issues of social justice, and other issues of concern that is amazing to me in many ways that these issues have not yet gone away. Mm-hmm. We've gotten better, I think, in a lot of things, but I do often wish my dad was still around waving the flag and leading the charge and tilting at the windmills. But I do thank you so very much for this honor for our family, my sister who lives 3,000 miles away and couldn't be here, my son who's my dad's grandson, and my dad's wife Jackie in Portland. And so I'm here representing all of us, as well as my brother who passed away a couple years ago. So thank you again, and I really, really appreciate this honor for my dad.
My name is Judy Signet. I currently work as the LA for Representative Brad Witt, but for 38 years, on and off, I worked for Ted Halleck. I began in the 1969 session, and halfway through it, when she took a permanent job somewhere else, it kind of went to work for him because I had just met him, to work against the sales tax at that time. His three main bills in that session were fluoridation of Oregon's waters. That subject's still around. Freedom of choice for women. And gun control. Those three are still with us today, some almost 40 years later, and they've not been resolved. But as she said, he tilted at windmills. In fact, he had a sign on his door that session that says, "Windmill Tilter." I don't know where that sign still exists somewhere or not, but over the years, he was also, I mean, he's the most famous for the land use planning, but he's also was the chair of the committee that developed the Department of Energy. He was very active in the South SLU of, in the Coos Bay area. He got, I think the first bill that he ever got through the legislature required testing of all babies in Oregon for PKU. Which means that we don't have that problem anymore. He was the drop-dead orator. He had that beautiful radio voice, and he could walk out on the floor. As she said, he had colorful language on the side aisle in the office. But he could walk on the floor and give a speech like you thought he had practiced it for years, and he never had. He just could drop-dead speak. And not only colorful, he was important to moving the system. He understood the value of having everyone come in one direction and moving them there. And that's a skill that has been lost by most people, or at least for the last few years it's been lost. And that's too bad. And I think that he well deserves this. And I hope that you will support it. Thank you very much. If you've got any questions.
I do have a question.
Yes.
Where are Senator Halleck's papers? And was, did he...
That's a question.
Was
for
he
her.
Interviewed by the Oregon Historical Society? Do we have any video recordings of him talking about his history of service?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there are lots of papers and records. I can't tell you for sure if there have been video interviews of him over the years. A lot of the papers are at the Oregon Historical Society. As a matter of fact, when we interred my dad's ashes, Tom Vaughn, who was the former head of the Historical Society, and his wife were there with us. And he's probably the expert on where all of the documentation of my dad's life is. Some of it is I have a little bit. My dad's wife, Jackie, has some of it as well, and so we've kind of been in the process of sorting out. Jackie's told me she has a trunk full mm-hmm. of things that she'd like me to go through. So we do have a lot at the Historical Society. So I'm not sure about the legislative piece of it, the papers, and who would keep that. But personal, World War II, he had a very varied career. He was the state coordinator for the Oregon Centennial in 1959, and there's a lot of material from that time, and much of it is at the Historical Society, and I'm one of these days going to go over there and just sit down, and Tom Vaughn said he'd help me kind of figure out where everything mm-hmm. is.
I asked the question thinking about the Hatfield School of Government at Portland State and how important it would be to make a connection for students going through that program with to make a connection with this history. There are so many wonderful public servants who've made their transition. They're gone, but their legacies and their papers and in some cases their voices are still with us, and we want to find ways, creative ways, to make this information available to our students so that they have a better understanding of what it is to give public service in our state and what it is to be a servant leader, as I believe he was. So that's where the my question and interest comes from.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Carter.
I was going to say to Stephanie, Senator Gordley is a historian with lots of passion. And one of the things that she did was to get a group of students at Portland State University who loves this. And so maybe one of the things for you to do is to talk to Senator Gordley in terms of how to get that done, and students who want to preserve history through the Hatfield School. To me, she's expert on this kind of stuff, so because she loves to preserve Oregon's history. And so I would encourage you to talk to Senator Gordley to make that happen, because it will happen for you faster, because they get credit for being able to do this.
That's a great idea. Thank you, Senator Carter. Mm-hmm. Thank you both.
Look forward to having that conversation with you.
Thank you.
Mr. Dewey, good morning.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Carter, Mike Dewey. It's a pleasure to be here on behalf of the Dewey family. And I say that because my father knew Ted Halleck very well, as did my mother. My father represented the Oregon Dental Association. There was a tie with fluoridation, but with some other issues, and working on behalf of the Oregon Dental Association, and then myself and my mother and our firm starting in 1973. I would say this. He was a man of great intellect, and when I started in 1973, I was somewhat afraid of him because he was so, if you will, smart. But he had a tremendous sense of humor. And if you walked by and you listened, and we already heard this, but I think it's important, as he spoke, the orator that he was, you sat down to listen no matter what the topic was. And he did it with a vocabulary that very few have. He did it with passion and panache. And by far, and I'll exclude the two people here today, in my whatever 34 years being in this process, he is number one in terms of being able to speak on the floor. And it would be nice for those that are starting this process to have an opportunity to see firsthand how you do it, because he was somebody that, as he spoke, could make a difference in talking about the various subjects. So I'm really proud to be here today, because we had a great affinity for Ted Halleck. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dewey. Ms. Halleck, I think we have a project to talk about beyond this meeting. Are there others present who would like to speak on this resolution? Okay. Anything else you would like to offer for the record?
I don't think so. Just, again, to thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you both. Thank you all. Thank you all. We will close the hearing on HCR 8. Okay, and we will open a hearing on House Bill 2188A.
House Bill 2188A expands the definition of authorized users to include parent or guardians of children under 18 years of age, clients 18 years of age or older, and post-secondary education institutions for the purpose of sharing immunization records through immunization registries.
Okay. We have a person who's traveled more than 100 miles to attend this meeting, and that is Janet, and I cannot read the last name, I'm sorry.
Patton, that's because I'm a doctor.
All right. Dr. Patton, please come forward.
Actually, I was going to go last because I summarized a number of the comments.
That's fine. Mm-hmm. That'll work. Lorraine Duncan, Greg Russell, and Kim Bartholomew. Good morning.
Good morning.
Who would like to begin?
I'll start. Yes. Good morning, Madam Chair and Senator Carter. My name is Lorraine Duncan. I'm the Immunization Program Manager for the Oregon Public Health Division, Department of Human Services. And I brought written testimony with me to share with you from Providence, Douglas County Health Department, the OSSU Student Health, Marion County Health Department, Oregon Education Association, and Oregon Health Sciences University. Thank you. I'd like to come today to ask for your support on House Bill 2188. We have a statewide immunization registry that currently is a childhood registry for those 0 to 18. It's for authorized users, which is doctors, nurses, and schools, to have complete records on children so that we're sure that they're getting immunized and that they can stay in school. The current registry, as I mentioned before, is for 0 to 18, and authorized users have access to that information 24/7 on a website. They can go in and look up a child by their first and last name, their birth date, and then it shows their immunizations that they've had, their complete history. If they've gone to numerous doctors, it combines those histories, and then it shows, based on that history, what shots they're due for today when they're in the clinic. The reason that we have it on the special web server is that we want that information separated from the demographic so that it's clear that authorized users need to have the information, but the demographics aren't shared with anyone unless they're doing tracking and recall efforts, reminding people about coming in for shots and like sending postcards or doing phone calls. This bill would put three steps into action. The first one is if we were able to have this law passed, we would have authorization to do a lifespan registry instead of just 0 to 18. The next step would be to expand the registry from 0 to 18, expand it to college students, which would be 0 to 23. And then from there we would look for additional funding, because we don't have funding currently, but you can't go ask for funding unless you have legislation. If you're talking to the federal government or you're talking to foundations and you want to have a lifespan registry and you're asking for money, they want to know if you have legal authority for it. So the first step is to get the bill, and the next step is to ask for the additional money. We would expand the registry in phases depending on funding that was available. We wouldn't be asking for general fund. We would be looking for federal or foundation dollars. I'd like to say that Oregon is one of the 10 states that has met the 2010 objectives around state immunization registries, where 95% of our children 6 and under are in the registry. But Oregon is not one of the 36 states that has expanded to lifespan. So for Oregon, the absence of a lifespan immunization system represents a missed opportunity to leverage one of the nation's most successful registries. Mm-hmm. So we're here today to ask for your support on 2188. Be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I have too many questions to ask, but I'll talk after it.
All right.
Because I'm not about this, but tell me your name again.
Lorraine Duncan.
Ms. Duncan, the reason I'm asking these questions, because as chair of the subcommittee on Ways and Means, this question was asked, and I know the department is here today. This question was asked in terms of, we're only at 62% of our kids having immunizations in the state, and yet we pay money through the Oregon Health Plan for that. We should have a better record of this. From what I can understand from OMAP is that our partner hospitals or medical people are not doing this. Yet after listening to you say that we have complete records on children on a website, that we have records that show the data on children and whether they're up to date on this, I'm having a problem understanding why we are not being much more formidable on our partners in terms of our children. And Doctor, I guess I wouldn't ask you this too when you get up. Why our children are lacking. 62% is abominable, and we are paying for these kind of services. How can you help me know what to do as it relates to the dollars that we give through OMAP, through OHP, to make sure that we have a better outcome than this? I mean, this is equivalent to Mississippi, and I was absolutely shocked to hear that.
Madam Chair and Senator Carter, I think you're referring to the recent hearing they had for Medicaid, and their rates are, like you said, 62%, and that's for two-year-olds. Statewide, we're in the 70%, still very low. All children in Oregon get their immunizations, but they get them late. They have them by the time they're entering school. We're in 97-98%. But the rates for two-year-olds are considerably low, and they're based on a series of vaccinations. And each year they add additional vaccinations to that. This year they added the varicella vaccine. So Oregon is not doing well on two-year-old immunization rates, not doing well at all. We're doing very well on adolescent immunizations, and we're doing well on adult immunizations. But two-year-old immunizations, we're not doing so well. The vaccines that are the most troublesome are the fourth diphtheria tetanus-containing vaccine, because that usually comes at 15 to 18 months of age, and that's not a normal time that kids go back into the doctor. That's the one that they're really low on. Also, varicella vaccine. And so you can the series that you're talking about where the 62% or the 72% statewide is, you know, four diphtheria tetanus-containing vaccines, you know, polio vaccine, measles, mumps, and rubella, hepatitis B. There's a series of those, but the ones that are holding us back, we're very good on most of them. We're up more in the 80%, but it's that fourth, that last diphtheria tetanus-containing vaccine and the varicella vaccine. Varicella and 4-Tdap are required for school, and they get them by the time they go to school. So we're trying through the registry and the work that public clinics do and health departments do to work on that 4-Tdap and varicella, because those are the two that are low. If we could get those up, the overall rate would go up. But that, when those two are low, the overall rate will never go up.
And so what strategies have been identified to address the issue that Senator Carter has raised?
Madam Chair and Senator Carter, we're trying to do a number of things. We're raising the awareness. We're having a public-private conference in Oregon for all Washington and Oregon providers May 15th and 16th, bringing all providers in both states together, looking at the issues of low immunization levels and how they can work to help us improve that. We're working through our statewide registry to do reminder recalls so that when children are due for immunizations that we can send a reminder out that immunizations will be coming up, and then if they miss that appointment that they could get a recall postcard. So the reminder, parents are very busy and there's lots of shots to be obtained, and if they can have an easy reminder, that really helps bring it to the forefront. Most providers are doing a really good job at that. We're also doing quality assurance visits to public and private providers and measuring each individual practice, how they're doing with providing technical assistance on ways that they could improve that practice. Most of them are very positive about trying to work on their efforts, and they're very surprised that their rates aren't higher than they are. Mm-hmm. If you ask providers, they all say that they're at 90%, but when you measure them, they're not at 90%. Yeah. And when they learn that, they're more than willing, you know, to start working on it. So it's an issue of bringing it to the forefront and making sure that they know so that they can help us work on it.
I would think that you are also faced with some cultural issues, cultural barriers, in as you identify your strategies and start talking about how you're going to roll those out. Are you enlisting the help of the Office of Minority Health within the Department of Human Services to help you pinpoint strategies that will be effective in reaching underserved populations, reaching culturally specific populations?
Madam Chair, yes, we have been working with the Office of Minority Health. We have a coalition in Oregon called the Oregon Partnership to Immunize Children,
yes.
And they have a task force that is working with the Office of Minority Health and have been doing a lot of work over the last several years. They did a special guide on race and ethnicity and what information providers need to have, kind of a toolkit, mm-hmm. which they rolled out last year, and we're continuing to provide that and work with the Oregon Partnership to Immunize Children on many issues to help in those populations. It's interesting, though, at the national level, for the very first time, when the 2005, actually, immunization levels were measured, it was the first time that there appeared to be less disparities across regarding race and ethnicity. And when we did our survey here in Oregon, we found the same thing, that it was pretty balanced among the races and ethnicity.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Appreciate your work.
Sure.
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, I'm Greg Russell, the immunization coordinator with the Washington County Department of Health and Human Services, and I'm here today to ask your support for House Bill 2188A. This bill, as you are aware, authorizes the expansion of ALERT from a childhood registry to a lifespan registry. The first phase of the process will be to expand the registry to age 23. Washington County is the second largest county in the state and surpassing the 500,000 mark. This, in terms of sheer numbers, makes it even more important to have adequate immunization records for preparedness and outbreak management. I have been involved with ALERT since its inception in 1996 and have watched it grow into a quality professional resource service. In my opinion, the ALERT registry has certainly been one of the most successful state programs and has been enthusiastically well received by physicians and nurses in public and private schools and certified child care facilities that I work with. From a large county health department perspective, expanding the ALERT immunization registry will be a huge benefit for our colleges and schools that particularly have a large base school population of 18 to 21. And current immunization records from STD clinics, correctional facilities, senior centers, and under-immunized populations will be a primary resource for public health issues that may arise in the future. And it's not uncommon for me to receive many requests for immunization records for occupational pre-employment, students starting college, and helping other out-of-state county health departments and schools seek immunizations from Oregon children who have moved to their states. And parents have been very appreciative that immunization records have been readily available. And this expansion and approval to a lifetime registry will both save time and energy and prevent duplicating immunizations already given. And this House bill has my full support, and thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much, Mr. Russell. We appreciate your leadership and your presence today.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chairperson Gordley and Senator Carter. My name is Kim Bartholomew, and I am a Beaverton School District nurse, and I am here on behalf of all Oregon School Nurse Association members, representing them as their person here today. I'm here to urge you to pass House Bill 2188A because it is important for all Oregonians. The bill would authorize the expansion of ALERT from the current childhood registry to a lifespan registry, and the first phase would of the process would expand the registry from age 0 to 23. Today I'm here to discuss specifically how the current ALERT policy affects my children in Beaverton. We have more than 37,000 kids in Beaverton, and over 1,220 of the kids are over 18. Now, keep in mind that students can attend school up to age 21, and while 3.5%, which is what the 1220 works out to be, doesn't seem terribly significant, that's still a large number of kids whose records I don't have access to. The number of students are disproportionately represented in our exclusion process of the kids who are 18 to 21. What I did was I asked the secretaries and the nurses from the other high schools to give me the number of children who were over 18 who were going to be part of the exclusion process. And at Sunset High School, 29% of the exclusion notices were kids who were over 18. At Beaverton High School, it's 21% of the notices that were sent to students who were over 18. At Westview High School, 36% of the exclusion notices were sent to families of students who were 18 to 21. Southridge was 18%, and Aloha High School was 33% of all exclusion notices were sent to families of students who were 18 to 21. Now, would I have been able to find these students in ALERT if I had been able to access their records? I don't know. Would I have found that their records were complete? I can't say for sure, but I would have liked the opportunity to find out if I could have helped them through the exclusion process. One student excluded unnecessarily is one student too many. While these are just statistical numbers on paper, please keep in mind that these are real students with real needs who can potentially miss school if their up-to-date immunization records are not brought in before exclusion day. Many students will miss several days due to the inability to obtain a timely appointment with their primary care provider. For a variety of reasons, we can't count on every parent, guardian, or emancipated student to bring in their immunization records. Life happens. We have students who are homeless. We have students who are in foster care and they move from family to family. We have people who move every 6 months when the rent is students do. We have a variety of reasons that students can't access their records in an easy way, or family members can't access their records in an easy way. And that's why it's so very important that I have access to these records for the students who are age 18 to 21. I hear from the secretaries time and time again that they were able to eliminate many of the children from the exclusion process simply by looking up their records in alerts. We should have the same capability to check the records of our older students just as we check our younger students. We should be able to serve all students equally well. House Bill 2188A would allow just that, the opportunity for us to serve all of our students equally well during the exclusion process. Also understand that this legislation would benefit many others, including teachers, family members, and school guests. In the event of a potential outbreak situation such as measles, I would be able to check the records of at-risk staff. Think about, you know, pregnant teachers, pregnant family members that come in and volunteer, school volunteers. And this situation is a distinct possibility. I had an experience last year when a very active parent volunteer called the school to notify us of her mumps diagnosis. Now, luckily, upon further laboratory evaluation, it wasn't mumps, but and the initial diagnosis was incorrect, but we may not be so lucky next time. My school district is not unique. My story is echoed by school staff all over the state. Oregon has always been a progressive state, and let's keep it that way. ALERT has been studied as a model immunization program, and this expansion is necessary if we wish to serve all of our students and all Oregonians well. Oregon School Nurse Association requests that you please show your support for this bill with a yes vote. I'm happy to provide you with any additional information, and that's about it. Now, on the back of this, I also included, in case you don't know what an alert record looks like, on the back of my testimony, I've included an alert record. And this particular record, now mind you, these are confidential records, and this is my own son's record, and so I'm giving you permission to look at my son's record here. I blacked it out. but as you see, it lists name, date of birth, and age, and that's all of the information that I get. I don't get any other information other than that. And then the immunization history. And as you can see, his immunizations are listed. And this would be very important, say, if he shows up in an emergency room, you know, I'm away, my husband has no clue when the last time he had his tetanus shot was, and he cut himself. And so the people in the emergency room can pull up this record and say, oh, 2004 was the last time he had his tetanus shot, he's fine. So that works out well for them. And in the schools, if the child has an accident in shop, it would be nice for me to have access to this record. So it is very important that we expand this registry to a lifetime registry so that I can serve all of my students and all of my family members in my district. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Ferdinand.
I want to not just compliment but commend all three of you and your presentations because you brought strategies forth and you were prepared for information that speak to all of Oregon's children. I am highly pleased with this panel's presentation, so thank you so much.
Thank you. Madam Chair?
Yes.
I would just like to ditto Senator Carter's comment, and you also brought passion. I love the way Ms. Martha Bartholomew started your testimony, by referring to my children.
They are.
Mm-hmm. That they came are. Through. Thank you.
Thank you.
To get back to the policy issue, I'd like you, and maybe I apologize for having to be in the room next door, but regarding the privacy issue, and if there were a situation in which a child did not want an ex-spouse, or the parent didn't want an ex-spouse, there was an abuse situation, how are those situations handled where their privacy? Because these people will track someone down if they want to find them. And could you address that issue? Because I know, but I want it on the record.
Sure, Madam Chair. The registry allows parents to, particularly for safety issues,
yes,
to submit a letter, and then their information is not shared. That we mark those, and then we do not share those. The legislation is silent on that issue for children, but it's very important that for safety reasons that we always allow that to happen, and we do.
Thank you. All right. Any other questions? Linda, is it Howery?
Okay, Dr. Bernard
Ufell
and Claudia Bach.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Linda Howery. I am a pharmacist here in the state of Oregon. I'm here today to represent, I'm also a member of the Oregon Adult Immunization Coalition. I have some testimony here that they're going to hand out, and you're perfectly capable of reading it, so I'm just going to try and summarize it really quickly. The Oregon Adult Immunization Coalition is made up of community members that have a stake in immunization practices throughout the state. There are physicians, nurses, pharmacists, schools, private practice, health plans, public health, parents, anybody who's interested in what immunization standards are in the state are welcome to join the coalition. The coalition is in support of this. Myself personally, as a pharmacist, I deal with only adult immunizations. Some of the things that happen in the coalition is that we have a whole group of people that are able to get together and talk about some of the barriers towards immunizing everybody, children and adults. For me as a pharmacist, what this bill would do is we get patients in our office all the time, elderly people who needed, we don't know if they need a pneumococcal or a PVD. They're not even aware of what that is. We get people in who need tetanus or have started a Hep A, Hep B series and can't remember who they are. So we as healthcare providers then have to make a decision about whether or not to immunize, whether the benefits outweigh the risk. Most of the time, we know that preventing a vaccine-preventable disease is more advantageous than going unvaccinated. Sometimes what happens is it's not until two, four, six months later that we find out we're not going to get reimbursed for that because that patient has already had that vaccine, only we had no way of knowing that. So what you have is you have a waste of resource, you have a waste of the vaccine, you have a waste of the provider time, you have a waste of the patient time, and a waste of money. This is one opportunity that would really allow us to understand that and to eliminate that problem. It would help us track some of the newer vaccines for the older children that are on the market. It is a way for pandemic planning, for us to enable our resources and streamline that. As you know, the last several years in the flu season has been a bit tricky with supply and demand on flu vaccine. Something like this would have really helped all of these partners in every asset of the healthcare profession to bring resources together to find out where our vaccine is, how can we stream that to those of highest risk. For me as a practitioner, this would be an absolute tremendous tool as a coalition. One of our goals is to provide our practitioners as many tools as we can to make immunization practices as safe and effective and increase those rates. So I truly do support this bill, and I hope that you would support it as well.
I'm Bernard Bufell, private practice pediatrician with a practice in Tigard. I use immunization registry on a regular basis. I actually, my office is one of the original test sites before Alert went live. I have secure access online, even from home if I should need it. And as stated before, the only demographic material that's available online is the child's name and birth date. And there's no way to tunnel through this particular computer to hack into some other parts to get anything else on this child. Approximately 80 to 90% of private providers participate in ALERT, and I believe 100% of state providers, of public providers. expanding the registry to adults would give family practice and internists the same access I have, which unfortunately goes away at 18, for their adult patients, such as finding the last tetanus, which most people can't remember. And those people don't get every 10 years like they should. There are quite a number of new vaccines that have been coming down the pike, such as HPV, meningococcal, and an adult tetanus diphtheria pertussis, since adults are a huge reservoir for giving whooping cough to young kids. More and more healthcare providers view immunizations not as just something that we do to kids, but that's important through your whole lifespan. The Alert Registry has a 10-year, very good history of addressing security issues and confidentiality, which can be applied to the expanding to the entire age group. In summary, I'm a very strong supporter of Alert. It helps me very often in my practice. It keeps me from having to call other offices and bugging parents to get me things from their physician. Most of the patients I look up, I can find. And it helps me not over-immunize, and also helps me find those kids, even when they're in for a cold, who are behind in a shot, to improve our, hopefully improve our two-year rates. Thank you.
I remember in when I was working for Clackamas County Public Health, and we didn't have the Alert, and we had the 3x5 cards, and we had thousands of them. And when the department said, "Okay, let's go with this," I had no one. I was in charge of the immunization program. No one wanted to do it, so I took a 19-year-old, and we learned that database, and we entered every 3x5 card, she and I, after hours, because I knew how valuable it was going to be. So I'm very, very excited about this.
The other thing it saves me is in January and February at school exclusion time, because now the school districts, the nurses, can go online and look up patients to find immunizations that may have been missing in the records that the parents gave them. Saves my medical assistant digging through charts. It's been a real boon. And it will be a real boon for the adult physicians.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Claudia Black, and I'm here today representing both the Oregon Medical Association and the Oregon Pediatric Society. I believe you have Dr. Lace's written testimony before you. He apologizes he couldn't be here today, but he's seeing patients. As you've heard, the Immunization Alert Program in Oregon has been very successful in recording children's immunizations. Children can change their health care providers, they can change their living circumstances, and still their immunization records can be immediately accessed. And this prevents, as you've heard, over-immunization and under-immunization, and assures that school-aged children can be appropriately immunized and therefore kept in school. The current law authorizes registry for children between the ages of 0 and 18, and House Bill 2188A would expand the registry to include adults through a phased-in program. We really support the expansion to include adults. Many adults are not sure when they've received vaccines, and I noticed a little bit of laughter up there about the tetanus piece. I think even though we're supposed to have them every 10 years, I don't think anybody off the top can say when they had their last one, or very few people. Also, occasionally we'll have elderly adults or people that have memory problems or brain injuries that have a difficult time expressing when they've had their immunizations, and this would give us an opportunity to access those easily. And finally, the university piece, kids going off to school that need access to their immunization records. And I had a personal experience with this. My own son, who is shot-averse, as in you practically can't drag him into a doctor's office. And when he was getting ready to go to college, they needed a copy. I'd moved, changed providers several times. I never worried about it. I'd never even kept the record because I knew that the doctor's offices kept those. Well, I found out when I started calling that they keep them for 7 years. You have a kid that's 18, that's a bit of a problem since most immunizations occur early. So from a personal point of view, and also representing the Oregon Medical Association and Oregon Pediatric Society, we urge your support of House Bill 2188A. Thank you. Question?
All right. Our final person, Dr. Janet
Patton.
Sorry, I can't read my writing. All right, I need glasses.
But at least you did tell us why.
Chairman Montes Anderson and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify on behalf of House Bill 2188A, the Lifetime Registry. My name is Janet Patton. I'm a family doctor. I work in Reedsport for the past 10 years. Our practice is pretty broad, and we work not only in the clinic, but also in the hospital, the nursing home, the emergency room, and the Shutter Creek Correctional Institute. I am a huge fan of Immunization Alert. I use this registry almost daily. We are one of the 87% of private practices who log all of the shots that we give into the registry. And I have long wished for this to be expanded to adults, so much so that I even proposed a research project to the Oregon Practice-Based Research Network at OHSU to test the usefulness of an adult registry as yet another way of getting funding for this project. If we get the legislative authority to do so, then there are lots of ways we can find to fund it. I called mine AIR, Adult Immunization Registry. And if you'll indulge me, I'd like to give you four examples of how such a registry could breathe fresh air on these common problems I see. First, in the emergency room with tetanus shots. I saw an 18-year-old with a head wound who needed stitches, and for a number of reasons, he was not thinking clearly. But I want to ask, who can remember when your last tetanus shot was? Raise your hand. Any idea?
Yeah, okay. Sort of.
And if you do, great. Was that DT or was it the Tdap that was mentioned? Now we all need one Tdap. These sorts of things are important to your doctor, important to your health, important to public health, but really hard to remember. And why should we have to remember? Your BlackBerry reminds you of appointments. Your cell phone remembers all the important phone numbers you need. Here we have a ready-made technology that only needs your okay and a little bit of tinkering to save wasting shots on adults with bad memories. I looked this kid up, and he is now up to date on his tetanus. But next month, when he's in an ATV wreck and goes to the ER in Coos Bay, he could get yet another shot, and that would be a waste. Secondly, in the hospital with the pneumonia vaccine, Lower Umpqua Hospital is part of Acumentris Health Pneumonia Project to improve outcomes for treatment of adult pneumonia. And one of the criteria is have adults gotten their pneumonia vaccine. You only need one after you're 65 or one before 65, depending on your health status. Once again, it's hard to remember. Did you get it at your doctor? Did you get it at the health department with a flu shot? Did you get it at the pharmacy? Has it been more than 2 years since your last one? Are you over 65? You know, you get someone who's 85, and heck if they can remember. The problem with just giving them an extra vaccine is that it's a combination vaccine, and the more you give, the less it works. So there is actually a downside to just giving the vaccine besides wasting money. Why can't we just look it up? We can, with your okay, and I'm really looking forward to that. Thirdly, in the clinic with the influenza vaccine, Medicare is moving to a pay-for-performance schedule where I will be dinged and possibly fined if I can't prove that a certain percentage of my adults who need it have received the flu vaccine, and they get them everywhere. It's hard to keep track and find who's falling through the cracks. How to fix that? AIR, Adult Registry. Fourthly, in prison, hepatitis C is a big problem. It's 80% of people with hep C will go on to chronic infection, and a third of them have liver failure. One of the things we have to slow that is to give vaccines against hepatitis A and B so they don't get yet another infection in the liver. It's hard to find records of prisoners, whether they've had one or two or any. It would be wonderful if we could just look it up and save everyone's time and money. What is the downside to having this adult registry? I can't think of any. It's secure, but let's say a hacker does get in. I mean, they see you got a shot. What are they going to do? You know, sell you Band-Aids and Tylenol. That's all I can think of. And for those who imagine something more apocalyptic, they can opt out. This will be a tremendous tool for improving the health of Oregonians, and I thank you for breathing air into a great idea.
Thank you very much. Questions? Comments?
I just want to, for the record, make sure that since this wasn't anticipated in the governor's recommended budget, that you went over the two-phase approach to expanding the existing registry. Has that been put on the record? We have the fiscal statement committee, and it talks about phase one, that expanding the existing registries to include 18 to 23-year-olds with an initial focus on college students, and then the phase two would be to expand the registries to include ages 23 and above.
Madam Chair, Lorraine Duncan, Immunization Program Manager. The phases for the registry, so to get the legislation passed was the first phase. The second phase is to expand for college students 0 to 23. We can do that with existing resources. Then we'll look for federal or foundation funds requiring no state general funds, so there's a zero fiscal impact statement on this bill.
Right. I just needed to make sure that was on the record. All right, any other discussion? Thank you very much for coming and for your testimony.
I'm so glad you said that, so Senator Monty Sanderson would not send me another unfunded mandate.
Yeah, I know. Sorry about that. Okay, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2188 and open a work session on House Bill 2188.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2188A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Gorley moves House Bill 2188A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered, and I would like to carry this bill. And I would like to reopen HCR 8 and ask Dave Barrows to please come up. He had some comments on Senator Ted Halleck.
Dave Barrows, for the record, Madam Chair, and thank you for your courtesy in letting me speak. I was down, actually, with Senator Courtney earlier this morning, the time that this was heard, speaking about the DEQ budget. It was public testimony day on that budget. I have known and worked closely with Senator Halleck for many, many years because I represent the ONC counties, very involved in timber issues. He was very involved in timber issues, ran the Wholesalers Association for Timber Sales, and we worked very closely together. I just want to make three points about him as an individual. Number one, you're all aware, he was a decorated war hero. The New Yorker magazine did a piece on him about 2 years ago that was absolutely marvelous. I mean, it was a New Yorker piece that just goes on and on and on for pages. It was a great description of Ted Halleck. Number two, we all are familiar with Senate Bill 100, the role that Governor McCaul played in that, the role that Senator Hector McPherson played in that. What has been lost a little bit in time was there were three people that really did Senate Bill 100, and Ted Halleck was the third person. And finally, I just want to, for those of you that didn't have the privilege of knowing him or serving with him, in my 52 years in this building, I would have to say, with due respect to all of you, and especially to the President of the Senate, he was probably the most unique floor speaker I've ever seen. When he spoke, it was dead silence. And the thing that made him so unique as a carrier of bills or an opponent of bills on the floor was he would paint a picture using two or three voices. It was absolutely spellbinding. And he was able to command the floor's attention because of this absolutely unique, I don't think I've ever seen anybody ever do it, not just raising voice, lowering the voice, but using two or three voices to get his point across. And he was an intelligent man, a caring man, a dedicated man, and I miss him personally, and the legislature lost a good advocate, a good senator when he left this body, and I'm delighted you're joining the House and honoring him as he should be. Thank you so much, and thank you for your courtesy this morning.
And thank you so much for your testimony, Mr. Barrows. With that, I'll close the public hearing on SCR 8, and evidently we couldn't go into work session. We didn't have a quorum on HCR 5. I'd like to open a work session on HCR 5.
Madam Chair, I move HCR 5 to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Gourley moves HCR 5 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. And
work the calendar as well. We have a quorum for that, for HCR.
Oh, we didn't have that quorum for that. Okay. Senator Gourley, would you like to carry the HCR 5? Is that?
Yes.
All right. And then I'd like to open a work session on HCR. Which one?
Madam Chair, I move HCR 8 to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Gourley moves HCR 8 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. And Senator Carter, would you carry HCR 8?
Great.
With that, we're adjourned.